This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today I'll be speaking with Carol Burris, the Executive Director of the Network for Public Education. She and Jeff Bryant have recently published a report entitled Asleep at the Wheel, How the Federal Charter Schools Program Recklessly Takes Taxpayers and Students for a Ride. The report documents ways that the U.S. Department of Education, as well as education administrators at the state level, are failing to exercise appropriate oversight with regard to hundreds of millions of dollars of funding to charter schools across the nation. Welcome, Carol.
Hi, good morning, Greg.
To begin with, could you tell our listeners something about the Network for Public Education, its work, and the origins of your newest report on the funding of charter schools?
Sure. The Network for Public Education was founded in 2013 by Diane Ravitch and Anthony Cody. We have about 330,000 supporters at this point. We're an advocacy organization for community-based, publicly governed public schools. Our members tend to be parents and teachers for the most part. And since I've become the executive director in 2015, our focus has been on research and on advocacy for bills that support what we consider to be true public education and working conditions for teachers, as well as advocacy for students who attend public schools, such as things like smaller class size, less testing, and issues like that. Regarding the report, we became interested in the charter schools program because we were reading some of the reports that were done by the Office of the Inspector General about the charter schools program that began back in 1994. And as I read through a lot of those OIG reports, I was horrified by what appeared to be the lack of supervision of hundreds of millions of dollars. And after each report, you get to see the department's response. And essentially, most of the time, the department's response was, well, we'll send out a dear colleague letter, which isn't much supervision at all. And the last report, which came out in 2018, Betsy DeVos's response was one of, well, you know, the funds, we send the funds out to the state and it's up to the states to deal with this. And no, we really shouldn't have any supervisory responsibility in this. And at that point, you know, that was sort of the last straw. And I said, you know, what we really need to do is to take a deep dive into this program and see what's going on.
So what specific programs did you take a look at and what methodology did you use to complete the research?
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Education's charter schools program has seven different funding streams, and we weren't able to look at all seven. So we took a look at three. The first one that we looked at is known as the non-state education agency grants, or non-SEAs. These are grants that go directly from the department to the charter school, and they go to charter schools in states that are not getting state grants. The second program, which is a much larger program, is the state grants program. These are huge sums of money that are given directly to the states, and then it is up to the states to disperse the money. And finally, we also took a look at the large grants that go to the charter management organizations. And the purpose of giving it to charter management organizations are to allow the charter management organizations to expand and increase the number of schools, as well as to add grade levels to the schools. So we began with the non-SEA grants. And what I started to do was to just take a look. There were the schools and there were the schools' applications, and to see if the schools were even there, you know, what I could learn about the schools. And I started to become very concerned because I saw a pattern. Turned out to be about 25% of the schools didn't exist, and in some cases had never existed at all. Because apparently these grants can even be given to schools before they're authorized and rolled out. And then I started to take a look at the applications themselves, as well as the review of the applications by the department. All of this is on the website. And I looked at it against the reality of the school itself. So, for example, if the school said that its purpose was to increase the number of English language learners, that was in the school, and that's what they were going to use the grant money for. And then I took and looked at the number of English language learners that the school had and found that it had 4% in a district in which 24% of the kids were English language learners. That raised a lot of bells and whistles. And what we found out subsequently is that the department does no reality check when they review the grants. Then after we looked at that, Jeff took a couple of years. We went through all of the grants. And then we said, look, we have to do a deep dive into this. Let's start to take a look at the state grants. And I chose the state of California simply because California has the most charter schools and therefore got the most money and grant money. And again, I'd looked at the question of, are these schools even there anymore? And so we took a look at a list of the SEA grants that were given between 2006 and 2014 to the state of California. We would have done other years, but unfortunately, that's all the department posted, even though they said they would keep the site up. And I compared the list of charter schools that got grants to the list of closed charter schools in the state of California. California does actually a very good job in that regard. And I found that a lot of these schools were no longer open. In fact, there were some that actually opened and closed on the same day. After that, I wanted to try to see if I could find schools that never even opened at all, if there were any. And sure enough, there were quite a few. And the way I did that was I checked the number, the grant number with the NCES number that was given next to the school that received the grant, and found that a lot of the schools didn't even have NCES numbers. And then I also did a final check against the California State Database of Charter Schools. So it was a very time-consuming process. But at the end of the day, what we found was that 39% of all of the charter schools that had received grants through that program were no longer in existence. And about half of that 39% had either never opened at all or had shut its doors in less than a year. And then finally, for the CMOs, the methodology that we used was I chose the largest grant, which was the grant given to IDEA charter schools. And I did a deep dive into those charter schools, especially the ones in San Antonio, Texas. Also did a dive into a smaller charter school CMO, Great Oaks. And then Jeff also went through some of the charter school CMOs to see what we could learn. So it was a big job that could have continued for much longer, but we wanted to make sure that we got everything done by the end of March.
Well, it sounds like it was an incredible effort to kind of go through all of that information. I'd like to walk through each of your findings and have you elaborate upon them so that our listeners are able to get a full sense of the scope of your report. As you indicate, I think one of the most stunning discoveries was the fact that so many of these schools have, in fact, shut down or never even opened. And I would be interested whether you can say more about the problems and that particular problem, what factors may have contributed is a low success rate of these charter schools.
Yeah, it's interesting that one-third rate has come up in a variety of places. There was a study done that was NEA a couple of years ago, and they found that one third of all charter schools failed within the first decade, and that if you stretched it out to 14 years, the number increased to 40%. So the failure rate of charter schools, while it's not often discussed, is a very, very serious problem. And in our case, I think we found numbers that were a little higher because we were also looking at ones that never opened at all. So we kept seeing this repetition. We saw the 39% in California. We already knew that there were high numbers from a report that the Center for Media and Democracy had done a few years ago in Michigan. I recently took a look at the Florida charter schools that got grants. That number was 37%. And then finally, the department itself admitted when it did a report in 2015, that of the schools that had received grants between the years of 2006 and 2014, fully one third of them either had shut down or, as they put it, had not opened yet. So it's very, very clear. And, you know, and from that, we got a lot of criticism because we had one line in the report that said, this could be close to $1 billion. But the truth of the matter is this is a program that has spent over $4 billion in seed money. We're seeing a one-third failure rate is a modest estimation from what we saw. So if you do the math, you're talking about maybe upwards of $1 billion having been wasted.
As you describe it, the grant application process adopted by the Department of Ed's Charter Schools Program may have contributed to the situation. How so?
Oh, absolutely. For one thing, when you take a look at the non-SEA grants, which are the applications that you can see online, there are directions that are on the website that says that the people who review the grants, the grant applications, and they are all consultants that are brought in to do the job, they have to have some connection with charter schools, that they're not allowed to look at any outside information. Now, I think the rationale for that is that they don't want people to be prejudiced by what they might see about the charter school. However, the problem is that it can become an invitation for fiction writing. As Mike Weinrib, New York Times reporter, wrote back in, I think it was 2011, when he was talking about a charter school that had received a grant in New Jersey. So, and we saw those discrepancies. I mean, there were times where the charter school did not provide information that was true. But most of the time, what we realized happened was that they presented information in such a light where they massaged data so that it put the charter school in the best light, which is understandable. But then there was no one who would be the referee to say, hey, wait a minute, how come you didn't report your achievement results, you know, in English language arts? Or how come your rate of kids who are English language learners is 4%, but the district in which you exist, the rate is 24%? And I mean, and that actually was one of the ones that we found. We also found things like by visiting the websites, there's one charter school in York City, Pennsylvania. It's called York Academy. And it's received two grants, substantial grants, over $1 million. And it talks in its application about how it wants to attract kids who are special education students and English language learners. But meanwhile, on their website, I found a statement that said, you know, we have gifted and talented programs. Our programs are for students with mild disabilities only. Now, I think that might be a violation of federal law, though I'm not certain. But the truth of the matter is, whether it was or it wasn't, that's a dog whistle that's being sent. And then, of course, when you take a look at the proportion of kids who have disabilities in the school compared to that of York City, you see that it's much, much lower. There are far more students who are white that attend the charter school than attend York City public schools. Big, big differences in English language arts. And, you know, and so when people are sort of just writing and able to write what it is that folks want to hear, they're a lot more likely to get a grant. And some of them just may not really be equipped to run the school. And we found that in many cases as well.
So what do you think is contributing to the Department of Education's failure to adequately monitor the work of the charter schools program?
You know, it's very interesting. We tried to find out. We actually called them. I called OIG and they never returned my call. And Jeff called the charter schools program itself. And after about a week, he sent them emails, to a few department heads. They didn't respond. He got a call back after about a week and a half from someone who scolded him that said that he caused havoc in the department by sending several emails and that they would get back to him with his questions, which they never did. I don't think that they have sufficient staff, but I also don't think that there is a real will to supervise it properly. And you can't put it all on Betsy DeVos. I mean, you know, the problems we saw have been going back all through the Obama years as well, where it almost seems as though the philosophy is let's shovel this money out the door. We have a lot of it. This program is going to be, if DeVos gets her way, have half a billion dollars worth of funding this year. And the idea is, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom or not. And there's even statements on the website that say, hey, you know, this is the way it goes when you start new businesses and new ventures. Some of them fail. So it's as though they're very, very comfortable with the idea of one third or more falling apart in order to get the two thirds that they perceive to be successful.
So over the past decade, one of the serious issues facing charter schools has been the recurrent instance of financial mismanagement or outright fraud, something that has been especially problematic with charter management organizations or CMOs. Organizations responsible for the running of what is the equivalent of charter school franchises. How has this happened?
Well, you know, again, a lot of it depends on state law, and there are places that are certainly worse than others. I think a lot of the reason is that CMOs are allowed to be for-profit organizations. And in some states, for example, Florida, you're talking about upwards of 44% of the CMOs be for-profit. The laws very often allow related party transactions, and the allowance of for-profit CMOs occurs in almost every state. There are very few that ban them. Charter schools are allowed to skip the traditional bidding process, and that's where a lot of the problems happen. So the instances that you'll find all the time and they make the headlines is, you know, they'll be buying goods and services from their brother's company and there will be inflated prices, or there's a lot of shenanigans that happen around real estate where you have charter school operators that and CMOs that have buildings, and then what they do is they lease them to the charter schools and they charge exorbitant rates. And unfortunately, a lot of really, really bad actors have gone into the space, and it's been a problem. I mean, I'm looking at one right now in Florida, and this is a charter school chain that received It was upwards of $700,000 in grants, and it was started by a guy who has a website called schoolsforsale.com. I mean, what this guy David Mope does now is he buys and he sells schools, and he tries to help people start online virtual schools. But at one point, he was involved in charter schools in the state of Florida. Pushed a bunch of them through. The federal government obliged by giving Florida a grant, and Florida was happy to pass that grant on to Mr. Mope to start the schools. Within a year, no, 2 years, they shut down. He declared bankruptcy. The kids were out on the street with just a couple of weeks left in the term. And, you know, it was just a mess. And you see state grants and CMOs getting money, like Heritage Academy in Michigan, which is notorious. White Hat, their schools have gotten grants through this program. Academica, Charter Schools USA. I mean, these are the CMOs that always make the news because of different problems. And while they may not get a CMO grant directly from the charter schools program, what happens is they get the grants through the various states, sometimes going to the management company and then sometimes just going to all of their charter schools. I mean, the truth of the matter is there's money to be made in this, and not everybody has the best intentions.
So, over and beyond the waste of taxpayers' dollars, when charter schools close or remain open for short periods of time, what are the consequences for students, families, and communities?
Yeah, I mean, it's always very sad. I find it very sad whenever a school closes, whether it be a public school or a charter school or a private school. And when you're talking about closure rates like this, I mean, if you think about it, if one in three are closing, that's affecting, you know, a third of the kids that go to charter schools. You'll have situations like the one I just described with the charter schools run by Mr. Mope, where all of a sudden it's the middle of the term or it's the end of the term and the kids are scrambling. You know, they have no place to go. And it also affects public school districts. A couple of years ago, there was a charter chain in California known as the Livermore Charter Schools, and they were involved in all kinds of shady dealings, including bringing kids over from China, having them come to their charter schools, charging them tuition, and then shifting them around among the charter schools where their parents did not even know where they were. Became a huge scandal. Everything blew up. And suddenly you had a school district, a public school district, that had, it was about 900 children showing up at their door. Now, you know, as a former high school principal, I understand, you know, you get your classes set, you have your teachers hired, you have your books in place. If you suddenly have an influx of kids, hey, you don't know what to do. You know, where are you going to get the money? Where are you going to get the room to absorb them? So the effects on communities, on public schools, on the drain of funding from public schools when a new charter school comes into town and opening, all of these things are causing a lot of consternation and problems. And you are really starting to see now stories in the news. That phase where charter schools could seem to do no wrong, that phase has ended. And you see news agencies now being much more critical of charter schools and much more aware of the unintended consequences that occur to public school districts as well.
So what are your major takeaways from this report?
Oh my gosh. I think that there are a few. And we outline them in the report. One is that the big one is that hundreds of millions of dollars have been gifted to schools and never open or quickly shut their doors. And I think that we have to be much more cognizant about that. And if this program is going to continue, and our recommendation is that it be shut down at least temporarily until these problems are solved, they have to be a lot more careful as to who gets the money. The grant approval process, in our opinion, is irrational and it's irresponsible. We're very concerned, too, about grants that have been awarded to schools that actually provide barriers to enrollment based on ability, poverty, English language status, and disability. There were two major reports done by ACLUs about those barriers, one in California and one in Arizona. And sure enough, we took a look at the list of schools that they found problems in terms of accessibility. And there they were. They were on the list of schools that got grants from the U.S. Department of Education. The Office of Inspector General reports, they cannot be continued to be ignored. I mean, there were so many reports that raised serious concerns. And this hand wave of this is not our problem. This is a problem with the states, or the responsive, we're going to send a dear colleague letter. I mean, that we don't think is sufficient. There is incredibly weak oversight when it comes to the state grants. I'm very familiar with the charter schools in California, having done an in-depth series of reports on them a couple of years ago. And there were some very, very bad actors that were getting money, charter schools and shopping malls with graduation rates less than 10%. Somehow the federal government has to create some rules of the road so that the states are not just handing these grants out to pretty much anybody who applies. And then, there has to be a look at the CMO grants to make sure that there are not going to charter management organizations that allow conflicts of interest. And that they're not going to for-profit CMOs either directly or indirectly through the states.
So in our last couple of minutes, now that you know what you know, where do you go from here? And will you be looking at anything else?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's... to me, it's all very interesting. I came into this work. I was a high school principal for many years and a researcher. And to be honest, I didn't have much of an opinion either way about charter schools. And it was only when I started to do some of these deep dives that I became very, very concerned for the well-being of public education, which I think is the pillar of our democracy, and for the kids that were attending these schools. Certainly, we know that there are charter schools that are doing a fine job. But there are some huge problems with the sector that have to be fixed. And for right now, I'm going to be continuing to do more deep dives into the charter school programs. Jeff and I just touched on the tip of the iceberg. What we did for California, I am now doing for the state of Florida. I'm going to do also for the state of Ohio and for Texas. And we also somehow have to take a look at the facilities grants too, which is the money that's being given out for charter schools facilities, because everybody knows there's a lot of very sketchy, to use an unscientific word, stuff that's happening with real estate and charter schools. And that really deserves our attention as well. The whole purpose of it really is to raise public awareness. We certainly got the ear of some members of Congress during the last hearing. There were questions that were raised to Betsy DeVos, and now it's our job to make sure that Congress continues to ask those questions, to put some pressure on the department. And if they don't, well, we're going to hold them accountable, because they can no longer claim that they didn't know what was going on.
Well, many thanks, Carol. Hopefully your report will encourage both the public and their representatives to require education officials at the federal and state levels to exercise more care as they invest taxpayer dollars in what is becoming a kind of Wild West of educational innovation and investment. This is Greg Smith with the National Education Policy Center. May's Education Interview of the Month will be with Alex Molnar and Faith Boninger. They have recently written another policy brief about the impact of commercial forces on education entitled Privatized Curriculum. We invite you to join us for another podcast.